Well, that's a nice bit of silence. Or, it's what they call Sod's Law. We always started late, so I thought I'd come late. And of course, as soon as I come late, everyone is in the room relatively early, so do apologize for that. Can I just say, this is the fourth in the series of five lectures that I'm giving. I hope I might persuade at least some of you to stay on for the fifth lecture next week, which is going to be about global divisions, global inequalities, major structural conflicts in the world, and therefore I hope is still a theme of interest to most people here. In starting this lecture, can I take you back a bit to where I began in the first lecture I gave, where I was talking about what it means to live in a global age. And I was arguing in that lecture that I have a different view of globalization from most of the people who currently write about it. A different view in two respects. First of all, most writers now tend to equate globalization with the expansion of markets, the expansion of free trade, if you like, across the world, which for me, however, is only one narrow aspect of what's happening in the world that one wants to subsume under the ideas of globalization or the global age. Globalization is about far more than that. And second, most writers today do something which they shouldn't do, I think, that is they treat globalization as something out there for the industrial countries. Globalization is like either a synonym for what's happening in the international arena, or it's a kind of synonym even for the developing world. But I've tried to argue through these lectures that globalization fundamentally influences and changes the nature of the industrial countries too, our societies in which we live. And one of the prime reasons for that is that the driving force of globalization or the global age, in my view anyway, is not markets, it's the impact of communications and media, which mean we simply have a different texture of experience from previous generations where the kind of immediacy of communication that we have now, which is only really constructed over the past 30 or so years, this is something really new in people's experience. And it's a new feature in the structuring of our societies too. And as I'll be arguing in this lecture, it's very intimately related to the rise of the new terrorism and the impact of terrorism in our lives today. Think back to the American election. Just before the American election, Osama bin Laden produced a video which played some part, and we don't know what, in the electoral process. I don't think you find any previous election with an analog to this where many quite serious commentators in the newspapers were asking who did Osama want to win the American election. Did he want Bush to win or did he want Kerry to win? And there are commentators who took both sides of that argument. Not only that, I don't know how many people here have either seen the bin Laden video or read the text of it, but that's also extremely interesting because the text of the video seems to imply that Osama probably saw Fahrenheit 9/11 because there's one telling phrase in it. How many people here have seen Fahrenheit 9/11? Well, that's a lot. You remember what to me was one of the most sort of transfixing parts of the film was when George Bush himself was transfixed in the school classroom when he was listening to this story about a goat, and he stayed for, what was it, about 4.5 minutes in the classroom when the Twin Towers were attacked. And bin Laden in his video says, what kind of leader is this when his country is under intensive attack since in a classroom being preoccupied with a story of a goat? And there's something about the immediacy of this relationship, which I've argued is not just a political thing, it's a kind of everyday thing for us. And I called that in the first lecture, everyday culture shock. Everyday culture shock is not always shock, but it's an everyday contact between the different cultures of the world, which are no longer out there for us. They're here and they're present and they're everywhere. And their manifestations are everywhere. Think of the horrific murder of the journalist that just happened in the Netherlands. A journalist who spoke out very forcefully against what he saw as the intolerance of Islam, and was murdered in a brutal way, in a way which has a clear analog to the kidnappings and murders that have happened in the context of the Iraq War, and where, you know, it might have happened before, who knows, but there seems to be, I think, a sort of televisual link in these occurrences. So everyday culture shock is something that we have to live with, but something which sort of very much influences our decisions, our lives, and even the political process in Western societies today. But what you can say here is that we no longer have to go out and get to the world. You can't insulate the problems of the world from our societies. Those problems will come to you. If you don't deal with those problems will now come to you. And you should remember 9/11 is perhaps still the most dramatic expression of that, because it was the first major successful attack on the American mainland since the British razed the capital, Washington, some 200 years previously. America seemed to be territorially secure, way distant from the big conflicts of the world, which to some extent it had sponsored and certainly it had been involved in during the Cold War period. Those things never came to America. Of course, the threat of nuclear annihilation was always there. Those missiles could come to America, but this was a kind of coming to America which really shattered people's sense of security and geographical integrity. I think one of the things Europeans on the whole still find it difficult to grasp is what dramatic impact September 11 had on the American psyche, and there's no doubt that that impact was a continuing feature, really, of the results which for better or for worse, propelled Mr. Bush back to power. So a part of my theme in this lecture is the intrinsic connection between communications and violence, just as the whole theme of all the lectures really is significance of communication and transformations in our lives. Now, when you look at the origin of the term terrorism, do you ask yourself, can the term terrorism have a reasonably objective social scientific meaning? Very important issue, I think. The term terrorism seems to have its origins in the French Revolution, in the revolutionary terror perpetrated during that process. The term terror wasn't invented by the revolutionaries themselves. The term terror was invented by the counter-revolutionaries, the people who despised the French Revolution and what it stood for, and believed the bloodletting which went on was a form of, as they said, terrorizing the population. So the term terror seems to have been invented at that period. But of course, you could say the phenomenon of terrorizing people through violence is as old as history, because if you look back into the history of the ancient civilizations, everybody here will know, I think, that when one army invaded a city held by the enemy, they would sometimes raise the entire city to the ground and kill all the men, women, and children in the city. This was, you know, not at all uncommon in traditional civilizations. And the point of it was terror. The point of it was not just to dispose, as it were, physically of the enemy within the city. The point was to create terror in those living in other cities in the enemy territory and to show the power which that terror represented. And of course, terror was used in the practice, for example, of putting severed heads on pikes outside city limits in Britain until surprisingly late time in European history. These sorts of things were a fairly common phenomenon. So the phenomenon of using violence with the idea of terrifying populations, especially civilian populations, is obviously old, but the term is new. And I'll be arguing that essentially the phenomenon is new, and especially what we now call terrorism is a much newer phenomenon than even the French Revolution. Terrorism, as a term, doesn't date for the time at which terror was first coined. Terrorism only became widely used in the early years of the 20th century. So, and when you have a fairly recent term which becomes fairly widely used, it normally reflects changes in the phenomenon, and I'll be describing a bit later why I think that the notion of terrorism and the fact of terrorism in a certain modern sense is relatively recent. And a particular form of terrorism, which I'll call new style terrorism or the new terrorism, is actually very recent and linked to the phenomenon of the global age, which I was discussing a bit earlier. Now, there are two questions which arise when you consider the problem: can terrorism be a useful concept for the social scientist? That is, can you use it in a reasonably objective way? First of all, there is the question of moral valuation. It's famous that one person's terrorist and another person's freedom fighter, and another person's freedom fighter is third person's terrorist. And so you can use these terms in shifting ways. It's also very well known that people who are terrorists at one point themselves can later come to condemn terror just as violently as they practiced it. And you could say some reservations, the early history of Israel, for example, was punctuated by terrorist activity. But today, of course, the Israeli leadership is part and parcel, self-declaredly, of the war on terror and regards terror and terrorists as its primary enemy. You also have moral shifts, because it's not that long ago that Nelson Mandela was widely regarded as a terrorist and widely reviled, actually, as a terrorist leader, potential terrorist leader within the ANC. But of course, Nelson Mandela has now become one of the most revered figures, not the most revered figure, of the late 20th century. So there is that kind of issue. Can you free the term terrorism from a certain level of moral valuation, where that moral evaluation shifts across time or shifts according to the perspective of the observer? And the second issue, I think, is the role of the state. Can states be said to practice terrorism? Because whatever people now say about the big corporations or whatever, states have been responsible for far more deaths in human history than any other type of organizations. States have brutally murdered populations, and this includes civilian populations. I mean, states have certainly, in modern times, carried out the kind of analog to the razing of cities that happened in traditional civilizations. You only have to think of the Queen's visit to Germany a couple of weeks ago, where the issue of Dresden was raised. Dresden was firebombed. Many thousands of people died. The city was at that point largely razed to the ground, and it had no obvious strategic advantage, many historians think, at that time of the war. So it could be described as an act of wanton terror, certainly by the critics of the Allies' actions. It has been described in that way, in which many people died and in which the purpose was to produce terror within the wider society of Germany. So the question of whether you can have an objective definition is therefore a difficult one, and it raises lots more issues than I can really discuss here. So I'm just going to offer what is a fairly dogmatic conceptualization of terrorism, because I think, having thought about the issue quite a bit, that you can have a reasonably objective definition of terrorism. And terrorism, defined as I'll try to do in a minute, is a major force affecting our lives today, and it is different from other kinds of violence which are practiced in other contexts. So let me just sort of say what my definition is. Got these various elements. First of all, I think terrorism should be separated from the activities of the state. Maybe there are contexts in which one can use the term state terrorism, but I'll separate it from the activities of the state. And I define terrorism as the following. Terrorism, first of all, involves acts of violence, physical violence. Second, used by non-state actors, whatever these be, whether they be quasi-combat units or what, normally targeted at civilian or non-combatant targets, normally targeted at civilians or those who are not themselves fighters. And crucially, where the violence involved is more symbolic than strategic. Where the violence involved is more symbolic than strategic, because the point of terrorism is to terrorize. The point is to instill fear and anxiety in principally a civilian population. So the main characteristics will be violence used by non-state actors directed mainly at civilian or non-combatant populations, where the violence involved is more strategic than symbolic. But like any concept of terrorism, it's fuzzy around the edges, and there will always be definitional problems around what terrorism actually is. I want to argue that terrorism in this sense is, as I mentioned a bit earlier, a specifically modern phenomenon. I would therefore want to separate it from acts of violence designed to terrorize that happened in previous periods of history. The reason why I think terrorism, in the sense in which I'm using it, is a relatively recent phenomenon is, again, its connection with communications. If you're going to terrorize populations on a fairly wide spectrum, you need to bring the information about the violence quickly to those populations affected. So terrorism, to me, is largely contingent on the rise of modern communications, which it makes it possible to do this. The rise of modern communications, as I mentioned, is essentially a sort of late 19th century process with the invention of the electronic telegraph, which made possible transcendence of time and space. Once this happens, then you tend to get the rise of symbolic acts of terrorist violence, which can be projected at distance. You don't have to be local in order to know about them. It's very important this. I don't know how far people are familiar with the sort of history of communications and geography, but before the invention of the electronic telegraph, it took a long, long while for news or information to percolate around. You couldn't have an immediate influence on a situation, process, or acts of violence in an immediate sense before something like the middle of the 19th century. Even in the early part of the 19th century, late 18th century, battles were fought in wars where peace had actually been concluded, but it took so long for the news to get back that the battles were fought without people realizing that the wars had ended. One of the main battles in the American Civil War, for example, fought out in the South, actually happened something like 2 months after the war had formally ended. And this was the nature of communications in those times. So I think terrorism, a phenomenon which tries to influence civilian populations at distance, is a creation of modern mass communications, and especially electronic communication. And of course, it links in with these fantastic transformations in recent times, which I've mentioned in previous lectures and which I'll come back to a bit earlier. Now, the bulk of what I want to say in this lecture is that we have to make a distinction between what I call old-style and new-style terrorism. Old-style terrorism is the kind of terrorism which has been dominant for something like 60, 70, 80 years in the early part of the 20th century. Still exists today, but has certain distinctive characteristics. Old-style terrorism is largely associated with the rise of nationalism and with the somewhat artificial process of the establishing of nations. There are many, many views about nationalism and its origins, but my view anyway, for what it's worth, is a kind of Ernest Gellner-type view that nationalism is a creation of modernity. It's a phenomenon of something like the late 18th century onwards, although you find residues early on. Anthony Smith argues this very strongly in the LSE. He says it goes back earlier, but I think it's more of a modern phenomenon. The rise of the idea of the myth of the nation, the integrity of sovereignty, the idea of bounded territories associated with national identity. Now, in all nations, the boundaries of nations were fixed somewhat arbitrarily. They were fixed either as lines on a map, as happened in Africa or Asia, essentially by Western colonizers, or they were fixed through conquest, battle, struggle. Think of this country, for example, United Kingdom. United Kingdom is a nation with territorial integrity, but of course it involved history of warfare. Scotland was brought in after several wars in active union. The Welsh were never completely integrated into wider British society and felt themselves to be, to some extent, a subjugated people. And Ireland was the crucial arena for the British in terms of its desire to have a separate national identity. I'm going back to at least the mid-19th century. Now, when you have patchwork nations, all nations to some extent founded on force and a kind of patchwork, then you have many examples of what you can call, and students in the field call, nations without states. Nations without states are nations with a claim to having a common cultural identity, a claim to the sort of mythos of the nation, but without the territorial and state apparatus which normally belongs with a nation. And most forms of old-style terrorism are linked to nations without states, and the point of old-style terrorism is to establish states in areas where nations do not have control of a territory or a state apparatus. This is true of Northern Ireland, for example, or one side of the competence in Northern Ireland, of the Basque Country in Europe, for example, and various forms of violence associated with Quebecois nationalism. There are issues like Kashmir and many other situations like that, where the main issue is territorial integrity and identity in the formation of a state. What terrorists want to do is to have an integral state in normally a sub-arena of an existing state, where the existing state lays claim to overall territorial sovereignty, and where terrorists are prepared to use violence to achieve their ends. Old-style terrorism is fundamentally local, therefore, because its ambitions are local. It wants to establish a state in a specific national area, and once that ambition has been realized, of course, that's the situation under which terrorists can then become heroes, or those who are once reviled as terrorists can become national leaders of the state which emerges, and can then become, as it were, perfectly respectable politicians leading the new nation. Now, old-style terrorism, especially in recent years, has had a kind of international component to it, because countries like Libya or Syria and some of the East European countries, for example, and groups in the United States have supported the IRA in Northern Ireland. And Basque terrorism, to some extent, has become internationalized. So you couldn't say old-style terrorism is wholly local, but it's mainly local. Its ambitions are local, although it might involve a wider global network of supporters. It might involve the filtering of arms and drugs, you know, from different parts of the world to fund armaments and so forth. Old-style terrorism is fundamentally limited in its ambitions. And normally, in old-style terrorism, the violence involved is relatively limited. Many people have lost their lives as a result of the conflict in Northern Ireland. But the proportion of people killed in Northern Ireland, including British soldiers, is actually less than those who die in road accidents each year. So although quite significant numbers, of course, of people have been maimed and injured and killed, there's never been a kind of massive extension of that level of violence. And this is characteristic normally of old-style terrorism. Because it has relatively limited aims, the violence itself tends to be relatively limited, fearsome and horrific, though it may be, because it is often aimed at completely innocent populations. Old-style terrorism is difficult to combat, as the British have found for such a long time in Northern Ireland, for various reasons. It's difficult to combat because of the strong moral compulsion of the myth of national identity. It has a very energizing component to it, national identity, which can continue to fuel devotees of a movement which seeks to establish a state where there is a nation without a state. And it's also especially difficult to come to terms with when there are contested claims on the same set of land, on the same territory. This is true in Northern Ireland. Difficult to produce a settlement, although a settlement hopefully seems to be emerging, because what the parties want is completely different. One group wants to be part of the United Kingdom, the other wants to be part of Ireland. The same is true in Israel, where you could say, many neutral observers anyway say, that both sides have legitimacy in their claim to large chunks of the land which they occupy, although of course this is very heavily contested from those on both sides of the argument, extremely hard to resolve because they're fighting over large parts of the same land, not just trying to get a state where one didn't exist when there aren't subsidiary claims, as there are in the Basque Country, for example, which is much more like a movement which seeks to go a bit further beyond the autonomy which the Basques already have. However difficult it might be to eradicate old-style violence, however, myself, I think it's really important to draw a fundamental distinction between old-style terrorism, which, if you like, is 20th century terrorism, and new-style terrorism, which is essentially the terrorism of the global age, because it deploys the very techniques of communication and global spread which have constructed this new global period for us. And Al-Qaeda, but not only Al-Qaeda, I want to argue, are examples of new-style terrorism. Let me list the main characteristics as I would see them of what new-style terrorism is. First, new-style terrorism is different from old-style terrorism in respect to the scope of its claims. One of the distinguishing features of Al-Qaeda's view of the world, for example, is that it has geopolitical aims. It seeks to restructure world society. As you'll know, what the proponents of certain chunks of Al-Qaeda leadership want to do is to reconstruct an Islamic society, a caliphate, going all the way from Pakistan into Europe, to effect regime change in the Middle East. One of the origins of Al-Qaeda is to change the regime in Saudi Arabia, but also to re-establish strongly Islamic governments throughout the Middle East. It's also to recapture Northern Africa. And if you look at the various Al-Qaeda websites, it's also to partly reconquer Europe. Al-Qaeda takes a long view of history and says that over a period of 1,000 years, the West has expelled Islamic groups from those areas which it has legitimate claim to. These include, for example, the Balkans, or they include about half of Spain, because about half of Spain was ruled by the Moors for a long period. Quite large chunks of what we now regard as Europe were previously Islamic, were ruled either by the Ottoman Empire or were ruled from Northern Africa. And the point is to reestablish the global role of Islam in these regions and areas. So whereas old-style nationalism is local and linked to particular states, normally quite small states, new-style terrorism is global or is geopolitical in its ambitions. It wants to reverse the tide of world power. An interesting thing about Al-Qaeda and similar organizations is that it's a kind of modernist anti-modernism, because the new terrorist organizations make great use of modern communications. They make use of the whole sort of panoply, actually, of modern communications, but to criticize modernity, but to reverse the tide of modernity, reverse what is seen as a corrupt style of society emanating from the West, which has lost the moral compass which a true society should have. Second, if the first feature is geopolitical scope in terms of aims and ambitions, the second is organization. Mary Caldor, who's one of the heads of the Center for Global Governance in the LSE, the very organization to which I'm also now attached, has quite interestingly pointed to the similarities between new terrorist groups and NGOs. New terrorist groups, she says, and I think this is quite right, Al-Qaeda is like a kind of malign NGO because it deploys the same global forms of organization as NGOs do. It's driven by a sense of mission and commitment, just like, say, I don't want to say, you shouldn't draw this parallel too closely. It's an organizational parallel, but if you take an organization like Friends of the Earth, it's a very powerful global organization because it's driven by a sense of mission and commitment. And that sense of mission and commitment allows for a fairly loose global organization to flourish. It's a network type organization, just like Al-Qaeda is driven by a sense of mission. And, you know, Al-Qaeda has been very substantially weakened by the American attacks in Afghanistan. But it's also strong still because the moral conviction and fervor which drives this sense of mission can keep cells functioning even when some aspects of the overall organization have been weakened or broken, and that's what we're seeing in many parts of the world today. So there's a lot of autonomy in local cells, and these can sort of breed without really necessarily being in any strong sense directed from the center. Another characteristic is that these cells exist in many countries, or these groups exist in many countries, just like NGOs have global spread, so does Al-Qaeda. It's very contested what Al-Qaeda is now, especially after Afghanistan, but many students of Al-Qaeda, especially this book called Inside Al-Qaeda, which is one of the best ones I read, claims that there are still cells in something like 60 different countries, with something like 20,000 people prepared to die violently for the cause. Not all of them suicide bombers, but a certain proportion certainly prepared to sacrifice their lives for the cause, and existing semi-autonomously from, as it were, the center. The final characteristic, just like NGOs, is that the new terrorist organizations intersect with states. See, no NGO could flourish completely as a non-state organization. They all have some contacts and support from states, and this is true, Caldor says, of New Star terrorist organizations too, and so it is. So support from states like, say, Libya, or certainly Iraq for some kinds of organizations and so forth has been quite important to the survival. Thirdly, third difference between old-style and new-style terrorism is means. Old-style terrorism, as I mentioned, because it had relatively limited objectives, the violence involved was normally fairly limited and continues to be normally fairly limited. Chechnya is an example where it's becoming radicalized and the two are overlapping to some substantive degree. The new terrorism seems to be much more ruthless in the means it's prepared to use. And again, if anyone's concerned or interested in this, which I hope in some sense everybody will be, if you check some of the Al-Qaeda websites, they talk in extremely destructive language of the enemy being principally the United States, but to some extent the West as a whole. And they do explicitly say we should use whatever means we can. We will kill as many people as we can. It's very, very different from the style of violence characteristic of old-style terrorism. Now, in my view, it's these two second characteristics, organization and ruthlessness, which links new-style terrorism to mass destruction, the possibility of mass destruction. It's not as such weapons of mass destruction, about which I want to, well, want to speak a bit, all the time already seems to be sort of running out slightly. You have to regard the connection between mass destruction and weapons of mass destruction as a problematic one. Let me tell you why. If you look at the example of 9/11, what happened in 9/11? Well, about 3,000 people were killed in the Twin Towers. But if the planes, as they were designed to do it, hit at a slightly different angle, and the towers had collapsed immediately, 50,000 people would have lost their lives in the Twin Towers. I remember what Al-Qaeda was doing was striking at the centers of American economic power, military power, and political power. The second plane hit the Pentagon, but it didn't hit the part of the Pentagon where much more destruction could have happened. If the plane hit the right part where the networking capabilities of the Pentagon are, they could have more or less paralyzed American military capability, at least for a while, because it's very dependent on networks communication. And the third plane was only stopped from hitting the White House, you remember, by the bravery of some of the passengers on it who brought it down before it could actually hit that target. But if it had hit the White House and destroyed the White House, it would have been, you know, at the outer edge of the possibility of 9/11, there's a possibility of, you know, massive destruction with something like 60,000 people losing their lives and a kind of strike at the main nerve cells of American political, economic, and military power. So you don't need weapons of mass destruction to kill a lot of people if you're ruthless enough and if you're well organized enough, because only planes were used in that attack. So the connection between weapons of mass destruction and modern mass terrorism is more problematic, I think, than many people assume. But what about the issue of weapons of mass destruction? What kinds of weaponry are there around, and what likelihood is there that New Star terrorists could use them? Well, I was going to say more about this than I actually have time to. You have to treat not just the connection between weapons of mass destruction and modern mass terrorism as problematic, but also the concept of weapons of mass destruction. The concept of weapons of mass destruction is actually not a useful one, I think, when you look at the literature on the weaponry that can be deployed. One of the things that is stunning when you start to look at the literature is, however, that if you combine organization, ruthlessness, and modern weaponry, there could be truly horrendous events which could be threatened by the rise of new style terrorism. Summarizing very briefly, because I did want to say a lot more about this, but summarizing briefly, you have to distinguish among the various categories of what are ordinarily regarded as weapons of mass destruction. Chemical weapons are dangerous, yes. They could kill hundreds of people, who knows, thousands of people, if deployed in certain ways. But they don't have ultimate destructive power. The destructive power of chemical weapons, when you're talking against civilian populations rather than on a battlefield, is relatively limited. Much the same is true of biological weapons. Biological weapons, for example, ricin, are pretty fearsome and could certainly have destructive potential. They could cause panic, as to some extent even the original letters, you know, involving anthrax did in the United States about 3 or 4 years ago. About 5 people died then. You could certainly kill hundreds of people by either chemical or biological weapons, but their lethal potential does not extend beyond that. Therefore, I sympathize very much with people who say you must draw a distinction between biological and chemical weapons on the one hand, dangerous though they are, and nuclear weapons on the other. And the most significant problem facing the world and the most horrific conjunction between new style terrorism and modern weaponry is in the field of nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation. And it's nuclear proliferation which should primarily worry us, because nuclear weapons give terrorists the chance to destroy a whole city. nuclear weapons could, if certain kinds of nuclear weapons, if they get in the hands of the wrong groups, could kill millions of people, not just a few hundreds of people. And so much of the effort which is being directed on the so-called war on terror should instead be directed not just to contain proliferation, but actually produce deproliferation in the world, because the proliferation of nuclear weaponry is really dangerous. And it comes not from rogue states primarily, it comes from two sources, the ex-Soviet Union and to some extent Pakistan, when Pakistani scientists were involved in passing nuclear secrets to some extent around to different countries. In the Soviet Union, it's been calculated there's something like 50,000 nuclear weapons. And something like possibly a quarter of these are unaccounted for. We know many of them have been stolen. Some have been recovered. We don't know who stole them. General Abed, who is a sort of famous general cum politician in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, gave evidence before an international committee in which he said that over half of the so-called suitcase bombs that existed in the Soviet Union, which are 1 kiloton bombs, have gone missing. You can take those bombs in a suitcase, literally, and leave them in the middle of a city. Incidentally, you have to separate these from so-called dirty bombs. Dirty bombs are simply conventional explosives packed inside radioactive materials. Dirty bombs are relatively easy to make, and it's almost certain that a dirty bomb will be exploded somewhere at some point. But dirty bombs do not kill large numbers of civilian population. Other nuclear weapons can do. Al-Qaeda was trying to acquire nuclear weapons way back in the early 1990s, and we have evidence that they made connections with a range of countries in order to seek to do so. If Al-Qaeda, and there is not only Al-Qaeda, there are several other such groups out there in the global sort of internet network, if they brought a van into Times Square with a 10 kiloton bomb in it and exploded it, they could kill something like 500,000 people in the center of New York City, and they could devastate also wider areas around. See, it's this outer edge which is the most fearsome possible connection, and therefore we need a much more rigorous regime of nuclear non-proliferation and deproliferation than we have so far. Since I have to accelerate, let me conclude by a number of brief observations that summarize at least my position on this. First, as I said, the notion of weapons of mass destruction has itself to be deconstructed is not really useful notion, at least has to be deployed with some care, partly because you can produce great destruction anyway without using such weapons, but partly because of the differentiation between them. Second, I don't believe in the war on terror. I don't believe in the war on terror because the whole point of new style terrorism, asymmetric violence, is that it's different from conventional war. It is not a war in the conventional sense. You do have to fight it in some part through the use of violence. I think it was necessary for the Americans to destroy the Al-Qaeda networks in Afghanistan because they were planning nuclear attacks on Western countries. But it's not a war in the conventional sense. And the most problematic thing within it is not just a war on terror, it's the problematic edge, especially of containing the possibility of nuclear violence and nuclear proliferation. Thirdly, we all have to be alert to what I'd call the phenomenology of risk and violence in the kind of world I'm describing, a mediatized world where you have mass terror which is deployed through modern techniques of videos, television, and so forth. The phenomenology of terror and threat for us is a difficult one to manage. The phenomenology of threat and terror is that often you have to announce a threat in order to get people to change their behavior or to take action against it. However, if you announce a threat and nothing happens, or you announce a threat and through announcing that threat you neutralize it, then people will accuse you of scaremongering. And this is exactly what a series of Channel 4 programs recently made about global terror did, I think. Part of the reason why the impact of global terror is less than it was is because the organization of Al-Qaeda at its original center has been in some part crippled. But of course, as soon as you're successful, people will say, why were you scaring us in the first place? But if you don't give information, then they will say cover up. They'll say you weren't providing enough information in the public domain. And all governments have to struggle with this difficult relationship between cover-ups and scaremongering, which is very difficult for us as a civilian population to deal with. Next, we do have to have preemptive doctrines, but these preemptive doctrines should be no way confined to terrorism. It's absurd, I think, position of the Bush administration. Preemptive doctrines against terrorism, no preemptive doctrines against global warming. You need a whole variety of preemptive doctrines if we're going to face up to the risks and threats that we have in the world. Finally, there is the problematic issue of civil liberties. What happens to our civil liberties in the age of the war on terror? Well, I think what's happening is wrong because, first of all, Guantanamo Bay is surely just a scandal. It's a kind of offshoring, the equivalent of industrial banking offshoring, really, to avoid the kinds of democratic rights that surely the whole point of fighting terrorism is to sustain those rights. That's surely a scandalous thing. But also, I think you get an attack on civil liberties if you bracket all weapons of mass destruction as the same and you bracket all terrorism as the same. We should be concentrating far more, as I've said several times, upon nuclear options and upon nuclear proliferation. We should not be just producing a blunt defamation of civil liberties in order to do that, because that has to be in some part geopolitically organized, not just a matter of vetting people when they come into a particular country. So I think the struggle against terrorism does not necessarily mean complete denial of human liberties, and we should stand up for the things which our society asserts as against New Star terrorism: human rights, democracy, political participation, equality, and therefore we must resist some of the entrenched reductions or reversals of human rights that have been carried out in the name of terrorism. Thank you very much, and I hope somebody comes next week too.